El siguiente es un programa pagado por el anunciante y 1600 AM no se hace responsable por las opiniones reflejadas en su contenido.
This is a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM, so please stay tuned.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlo Damrgardichian. I want to welcome you to another edition of our show. It's been a really busy semester, and we had our break, and the classes begin at Fresno State this week. So we will be back teaching virtually, of course, but we are continuing with our radio program. Today, I have the special honor of introducing my guest, Dr. Mary Papazian. She is the president of San Jose State University, and she has been president of San Jose State for the last 4 years. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Good to be here, Barlo. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's really great being able to talk to you. Dr. Papazian and I, Mary, go back to our times when we were both studying at UCLA many years ago. And before I talk to you and ask you questions about your tenure at San Jose State, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about your academic journey and about some of the ways and decisions that you took in order to eventually become a president. And I'm going to take you back to your undergraduate days and to your graduate days when you were working on your in the field of English literature. So tell us a little bit about that, your choice in the beginning, when you went to college, how you chose English, and a little bit about some of the work that you did in that field.
Well, thank you, and for reminding both of us that we've known each other, Barlo, a long time. When I was a child, I always had as a goal that I would go to UCLA and study English, and I think the reason for that was because that's what my mother did, and I admired her so much, and she really instilled the love of literature in me. And my parents met actually at UCLA. My mom was a student there, having been born in Los Angeles. My dad was an immigrant, an Armenian immigrant from Greece. And so UCLA held a special place for us. And so I went there and I studied English, and I had an amazing experience. I was active in the Armenian Students Association, and then I was also active in the English program, and ultimately ended up staying there for my graduate degree. I hadn't expected to, but they made me a good offer, and so I did.
And you've studied as your research interest both John Donne and John Milton. I was just reading a little bit about your background, and you were very much. I guess the word is inspired by them. And can you tell us a little bit about how studying their works have informed your own creative work and your creative life?
Well, you know, I became interested in Donne and Milton really through an extraordinary faculty member. And I think often that's what happens. You know, that's where teaching it can be so impactful. In the English department at the time, taking early courses, and Milton is a 17th century writer, was a requirement. I thought it would be just awful and dull. And so I put it off till the fall of my senior year. And I had a faculty member who was just extraordinary. He knew how to bring it to life with a kind of passion, and I really began to read it in a way that I probably never would have otherwise. And there was something about the way Donne and Milton, they were near contemporaries, really, I think, caught the spirit of the human spirit, if you will, at a time of great change. We were coming out of the medieval period. We were beginning to make many of the discoveries. This is the time America was discovered, if you will. And it really just brought, I think, a sensitivity and an insightfulness about human nature, both individually and collectively, that that touched me in ways I didn't expect.
And when you were studying them, that was your graduate thesis, right? You were studying them and writing about them.
Yeah, I actually wrote on Donne's. It's a prose poem, I call it. It's called The Devotions Upon Emergent Occasions, and it's where that very famous line, "For whom the bell tolls." Never seek to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee, and no man is an island. Both phrases people know well, which again speaks to the individual experience in illness, but the collective experience of a society. I will say, as I reflect back now, reading it in the time of a global pandemic today is really serendipitous and quite powerful.
Now, I was reading that also that you had actually made an interesting decision about your future career. At one point, you had to make a decision between sort of two different areas. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I always knew I would go to UCLA and study English. I never really thought about what happens when you graduate. That never occurred to me. I just knew I was going to get there. And once I got into college and was making my way through, I started to think, well, what am I going to do next? And what do you do with an English major? People think teaching, they think journalism, they think law. And I didn't want to do K-12 teaching or high school teaching. I admired it tremendously, and my mother taught for 30 years. I saw how hard she worked, and I thought, you know, I'm not sure that I'm ready for that. I thought about journalism. That was interesting to me. I thought about politics and running for elected office. I think that was from my time as actually with the Armenian community and as an intern with the assembly. And I thought about law. People said, you'd be really good at it. You love to argue. And my dad said that, actually. And so I really wasn't sure. I began to be thinking about graduate school and doing more with literature. And I was ready to apply to graduate school in English or to law school. I actually had the applications for both. And then I took that Milton class that I described a little bit earlier, and I thought to myself, Paradise Lost or Torts? And I decided Paradise Lost was much more inspiring. And I remember I was in the North Campus at UCLA. You remember that well, Barlow.
Right, uh-huh.
And I threw all the law school applications away and just went down the path of graduate education.
And then did you see yourself as teaching in after you got your doctorate? And tell us a little bit about your first job and about some of the experiences you had in first teaching.
Yeah, you know, it's I always was confident I would be able to, get a job as a professor of English. But it was really very difficult because there are always far more graduate, doctoral students graduating and looking than there are positions. But I was fortunate. I found one in actually had several options, and I chose the one at Oakland University in Michigan. A lot of people thought it was Oakland, California, and I had to explain, no, it was Oakland, Michigan. And one of the real attractions there was, first, it was a really great job. It's in the Detroit area, just north in the Detroit suburbs, and it had a really strong commitment to the liberal arts. And so I was really taken by the department. But then the added benefit, of course, was that there was a really strong Armenian community there. I had cousins there who we had visited many times as a, you know, when I was a child. So there was a certain familiarity to being in Detroit. So I made the trek from Southern California to Detroit from the sun to the winters. But it was a really great place to start a career.
And how did you like teaching? I mean, just as a, was it what you expected, or were there unexpected things that maybe you remember?
Well, I loved it, actually. I really tried to channel a lot of that, connectedness that I experienced from my faculty and to be present for students. Students at Oakland, like at Fresno State or like at San Jose State are, many of them are first-generation students, and so the impact that we have as individual faculty members can be really profound. And it was really exciting. I had great colleagues. I was, you know, asking questions and doing work and writing at the same time. And, you know, I was just really happy there. It was a wonderful experience.
And how did
challenges, of course, are in all the hard work we do behind the scenes, you know, the grading and all of that. But being with students is phenomenal.
So when did you actually begin to think about administration? How did that come about, that you started to get into the administration?
Well, it's very funny. When I was a graduate student, this professor, a mentor of mine, when he was writing my letters of recommendation for my first academic job, in the last, he said all nice things about my teaching, about my scholarship, my ability to be a good colleague. And in the last paragraph, he said, and she'll be a university president in 25 years. And I remember looking at him and saying, why are you writing that? You know, that's not going to be me. But he said, no, you have an ability to do it, but just don't think about it for a while. You know, do your academics, become a tenured professor. The time will come. And that's pretty much what happened. I was had just been tenured at Oakland, and we were going through a 10-year accreditation review, and I was tapped to help to write the report, the accreditation report. And by doing that, I really came to understand the university, you know, from its non-academic to its academic areas. And I think that's what really launched my administrative career.
And then even at that point, were you thinking, well, someday I'd like to just move up in the ranks, maybe not to president even, but just kind of make it more of a career track to be in the administrative side than the teaching side?
Well, you know, I became, right after we finished the accreditation piece, I was tapped to be Associate Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. And I think it was in that role where I really began to appreciate the broader impact that you could have in an administrative role, particularly an academic administrative role. And my colleagues would tease me, you've gone over to the dark side, you're wearing the scarlet A for administrator. And I said to them at the time, I said, you know, we complain that the top administrators don't understand the essence of what education is, or, you know, why it matters, the heart of the professor. And if people who understand that and care about it aren't willing to take some of these leadership positions, then we'll never be able to bridge that gap. So I what I found was compelling is that I could, in that case, impact, you know, the approach and the programs of a college of 22 different departments. And what I found is I would do that for a number of years. I was associate dean for 5 years. And then I realized I was ready to lead in that space. And then you think, okay, I'll take the next step. And then you grow in that. And then you're saying, I'm ready to lead in the next one. And then you move forward. You don't just jump from, you know, being a professor to being a president. It really is, you know, a ladder up where you learn at each phase.
And so you started as an associate dean, and then you moved to, where was it, Montclair State University as a dean, and then on in the sort of, as you said, the academic, or the administrative kind of ladder. So was that a problem for you to move around, or was that okay as far as just career opportunities, and you just kind of moved to different places?
Well, you know, it's always a complicated calculus, at least it was for me, because, you know, I was married and had two young children, and my husband, Dennis Papazian, was ran the Armenian Research Center that he had founded at University of Michigan, Dearborn. And so moving from Michigan to New Jersey, which, you know, where Montclair State is, was a big decision for us as a family. And we made the decision, our daughters at the time were 10 and 5, again, strong Armenian community. Dennis had worked for a long time, you know, in the New York area through the diocese and other entities. And Montclair State was the dean of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. It was a really good job. So that was a good move. I thought I'd be there for a while. But one of the things that was attractive about moving to New Jersey, right outside of New York City, is that Dennis said this, actually. This isn't your last job. And when you're ready to move, you know, to say a provost or chief academic officer, there's a lot of institutions in the broader New York City area. So you could move jobs without moving homes. And that was important, you know, because our girls were in school at the time. And so you look at all of that. But I have to say, it's interesting to go to new campuses. You see things that are very similar, but you also see different cultures at each of the individual campuses.
And you also were still sort of teaching and doing research, right, as well as doing the administrative work?
Yeah, it's not as much as I would like, but I still had my toe in it. So I taught a couple of courses at Montclair and published a collection of essays. And I taught at Lehman College, which is part of the City University of New York, where I was provost. And when I was there, the English department said to me, why don't you teach our graduate course in Milton? Right? You're the expert in it. And I said, no, I actually want to teach an introduction to literature class for our freshmen and sophomores so I could really understand our students. And that was incredibly rewarding. When I left Lehman to become president at Southern Connecticut, it was a little trickier, and I had wanted to, but my schedule, you know, just didn't make it possible. So I would do a lecture here or there as a guest in one of my colleagues' courses, but I couldn't really take the responsibility of a class.
And, you know, I'm looking within academics in my own position as I look at our own administrators and, you know, at Fresno State or anywhere. But as you rise in the academic, in the administrative levels, you get two things. You get more opportunities to do kind of the things that you want to, but you also get more challenges. That's a nice word, probably. Challenges, mm-hmm. meaning that, of course, all of the problems kind of go to the top. As you were rising up through the ranks, what did you think about your, in terms of what you wanted to achieve in those positions? What was kind of the motivating force for you?
Well, I think for me, I wanted to lift up the aspiration at wherever I was. You know, it meant really supporting when I was dean, hiring really outstanding faculty. Supporting those faculty, so they can be effective in the classroom. So they had the time to do their work, so they could really engage meaningfully in questions of discovery and in their own scholarship. And so, you know, really building up, the strength of the programs and the opportunities for students. And as you go, as I became provost, it was really elevating again the aspiration. It means investing in research for a lot of our faculty. It meant being much more creative about meeting students around student success, because suddenly you're now responsible for, you know, all of those metrics about graduation rates and everything else, and you start looking at that and say, okay, you know, are we really meeting students where they are? Are we providing the support? What are we missing? And you're in a position to empower people to begin to address those problems and to say, you know, and to direct the priorities. And so for me, it really was about creating a more vibrant, forward-looking, well-functioning institution where people wanted to come to work and students wanted to learn.
And when you are a dean or a provost, or especially as a president, you really have to be a people person, don't you? Because you have to interact with all segments of the university, from students to faculty to administrators, and then, of course, out into the community. So tell me a little bit about that part of it, how much you enjoy it, because you must enjoy it.
Well, you know, I indicated before that when I was back in college, I thought maybe I'd run for elected office. And I don't think you can do that if you don't like being with people. So, that's always been, something that brings me strength and brings me energy. I did one of these, these personality tests that you do years ago in a management leadership class. I did the Myers-Briggs. And I don't remember. I was pretty much half and half on just about every one. I don't remember even the letters. But the one that I wasn't, where I was 100% in one side versus the other, was the introvert-extrovert. No surprise, I was 100% on the extrovert side. So that I enjoy. But the really interesting thing is, and you really touched on it, I started to see our role as translators. But there's a lot of shared interests. But within the academy, we speak one language. You know, and outside in the community and in business and industry and with donors and the like, we might speak a different language with governing boards, advisory boards, and all of that. And so it's really important to be able to translate you know, between one and the other. And we will talk within the academy about the liberal arts or the humanities, right? But outside, they don't really want to hear it that way. They want to talk about the skills we're developing, perhaps, the communication skills, the understanding of our place in the world, the ability to work in teams, and all of those qualities that are very much at the heart of what we do in education. And so it's really important to be able to do that. And I think with donors in particular, to really generate the energy and the excitement about the work that we're doing. But the other key factor, I would say, you know, a lot of times people, persons, and I will, you know, say sometimes I'm guilty of this. We like to talk more than we should be, and we should listen a lot more and listen to what other people tell us, because that's really powerful when we're hearing what other people are understanding or what their values are or what they care about.
My guest today is Dr. Mary Papazian. She is the president of San Jose State University. She's a special guest today for our program. We're going to take a brief pause on All Things Armenian, and we will be back in just a moment.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlow Dermagerdichian. My special guest today is Dr. Mary Papazian, and she is the president of San Jose State University. I believe, isn't San Jose State the oldest in the Cal State system, Mary?
Yeah, it's the oldest public university in the West.
In the West. Wow, that's great. We're going to be talking about more of your role as president, but earlier you were talking about your various experiences and your journey to becoming president. And along the way, we mentioned and talked a little bit about your Armenian experience. And in this segment, I'd like to talk a little bit about that. You are Armenian, of course. You talked a little bit about your family. Tell me a little bit about a little bit more about your family, your parents, and your personal activity in the Armenian community, because I think that's of interest as well.
Sure. Well, I'll say that my great grandfather on my mother's side moved to Fresno in 1901. And so my grandfather on my mother's side was born in Fresno. He realized, my great-grandfather, that he wasn't much of a farmer, and he moved the family to Los Angeles in 1905. So my mother's family on her father's side was one of the first 10 Armenian families in Los Angeles. So that gives you an idea, given the huge population today. My grandmother also was born in Fresno, and then they moved down to Los Angeles, but not until the early 30s. So my mother's multi-generation, and I'm fourth generation Armenian American on her side. My father's family is from Greece, but they're originally from Sis in historic Armenia. My mother's family is from Marzavan and Malatya. So I grew up, in the community. My parents became very close friends early on for a variety of reasons with Richard Hovhannessian, the Dean of Armenian Studies, and my mother edited his books. And so we grew up in that world. One of my abiding memories as a seven-year-old is carrying a candle during the groundbreaking of the Armenian monument in Montebello. So very much a part of it. I remember standing at the street corner as the buses to Ferahian would drive by and waving to a friend on the bus and wanting to go there. When we moved from one part of L.A. to another, and my mother had started teaching there, she taught at Ferahian for 30 years, my brothers and I all went there. We lived next door to the principal and founder. So being in the Armenian community was really a part of our growing up. Most of the people we were with, though, were not so much born here, but many had come from other places. And so this has always been an essential part of who I am, and I carry it with me in whatever I do.
Well, yeah, I wanted to ask you that in more specifically. So when you reflect upon your upbringing and your activities, what lessons or what kinds of things do you feel that you learned that you bring to your position today as a president of a major university?
I think it's actually been very impactful. California, like most of the United States, and certainly San Jose State, like Fresno State and others, you know, are very diverse, multicultural places. We have students who have come from all over, multi-generational. They may be first in their families to go to college. They bring different experiences, different histories, different cultural perspective. And I think having grown up in a community that was, if you will, a hyphenated community that straddled two worlds makes you really sensitive to others who have done the same. And, I think for me, certainly, it has created a strong commitment to equity and justice. We grew up, of course, really working hard toward Armenian genocide recognition and many other things. And you start to see that same desire for being seen, right, and for having a place in a very, in this mosaic of American society that we find on our campuses, is really compelling. And I think, having lived with that myself, it really has enabled me to be not just interested in, but empathetic to those around us at the university.
You are, I think, the first Armenian American female president of a university in the United States. Is that right?
Yeah, the first and only, as I understand it.
Yeah, that's quite a distinction. What do you say to women in particular? I mean, students in general, women in particular, or just anyone about that experience? In other words, you're kind of a role model, aren't you? So tell us a little bit about how you try to communicate those opportunities to younger people, students.
Yeah, when I became president of Southern Connecticut State University in 2012, that was the first my first experience in that role, and I had people coming up to me and saying, they wanted to meet me, they wanted to talk to me, and so I would actually seek it out, and when I would go to Armenia, for example, I spoke at the American University of Armenia's Women's Center. I tried to be always present, and I've had multiple people ask to interview me for women's leadership for dissertations, and some of them are very specific to Armenian experiences. And I always say yes, because I appreciate that I've been fortunate, and whatever I could offer that can be helpful to others, I'm glad to do. The one request I got that I think touched me the most, and it just happened last year, was when I was asked, there was two younger women who were putting together a children's book on women leaders in Armenian history. And many of these were historic figures, going back. And they asked me to be a, would I be willing to be a part of this children's book that was really geared for young girls? And I thought, what a wonderful way to encourage young girls in the Armenian community to aspire to achieve their dreams.
And you mentioned Armenia, and I'd like to talk a little bit about that. So over the past few years, many years, I'm sure, but you've been very active, involved in traveling to Armenia, Artsakh, maybe. I don't know. We'll have to talk, see if you've been to Artsakh. But you've worked with universities there, Yerevan State University. You mentioned American University of Armenia, the State Pedagogical University. Tell us a little bit about some of those connections that you have established and what you're maybe even doing now with institutions in Armenia.
Yeah, my first trip to Armenia was in 1974. So I saw it in those Soviet times, and I was back again in the early 90s, right after independence, during those very dark days when you know, all the trees were being cut to burn for firewood. It's been a real focus for me. When I was at Southern Connecticut, we have strength in the health sciences, and so I was invited to participate in a medical conference, and I brought nursing faculty, non-Armenians, you know, to Armenia, and they became involved in really rethinking nursing education in Armenia, working in partnership with the faculty at the American University. And I've done the same with Yerevan State and the Pedagogical University. We have partnerships with all three of those universities that you mentioned. We're also working with the engineering, the Polytechnic School and other entities. One of the wonderful alignments with my role here in Silicon Valley at San Jose State, because we educate the workforce for Silicon Valley, we understand, we have faculty who understands the what it takes to be successful in the IT space. And of course, the fastest growing part of the Armenian economy is IT. And so there's a natural connection as we think about how to build the pipeline of talent to really build out the technology infrastructure in Armenia. We do this every day at San Jose State. And so I have gone several times with people from the institution, with deans and vice presidents to really try to connect and to build out some of those partnerships. We're working in the area specifically of creating curricula. We have a partnership with Yerevan State and one of the incubators, Enterprise Incubator, to do data analytics. We have partnering with the Masters in Data Analytics, and we're supposed to have several students coming, and they do part of their work at Yerevan State and part of their work at San Jose State. And so, you know, many other dimensions like that, we're looking to kind of be that nexus to bring the expertise, you know, to help support the growth of these of this industry in Armenia.
And I think when you talk about high tech, and you mentioned how it is what a growing sector in Armenia, but they also have a lot of things that probably could be sort of learned here, right? I mean, places like the Tumo Center or other sort of high-tech things for children, especially getting them in STEM and all of that. I think those are valuable for us too, isn't it?
It's really a two-way street, and I always say that, and my team sees it the same way. When my Dean of Professional and Global Education went with me to Tumo, she said, "Mary, this is amazing. My science dean, you know, was completely impressed by it." And we've been in partnership with Tumo and Mary Lou Papazian and others there to think about how we can create something like that here in the United States, because it really is such an innovative way to think about, creating, really fostering creative thinking and innovation. And so, the beautiful thing about Armenia is that it's so small that it can really be a laboratory for how to do things a little differently. And then we can think about how we can scale it up. So I agree. It's we learn from each other, and it's a partnership that we value tremendously.
Had you had an opportunity to visit Artsakh at all?
Yes, I was there, I want to say, about 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
and went was in Stepanakert and, you know, and Shushi and, you know, throughout. And it's a pretty amazing experience.
So do you have any continuing things? I mean, things you'd like to continue to do or new things, new projects perhaps with institutions in Armenia? Do you have anything on the horizon?
Yeah, we're working actively with these institutions right now, and we're continuing to develop, again, some of these academic programs, short-term kinds of experiences where our faculty, probably virtually now, which is so much easier, would do short courses for faculty at universities in Armenia, you know, to really build out some of the most cutting-edge skills that they need in order to update their curricula. So, you know, there's the whole AI Center at American University. We work closely with EPIC, which is the entrepreneurial program at AUA, and we've had EPIC students come and spend time on campus and work with our faculty through, and as well as with industry partnerships. So we're constantly, you know, looking at those partnerships. My dean of professional and graduate education is kind of a point person. The other person who's been involved is my dean of education, and really looking at ways that we can have an impact on particularly secondary education in science, in STEM, because this is something that had traditionally been strong in Armenia, but after independence, you know, that has been more challenging, and trying to kind of build out some best practices there. So we're looking at what we can do in that space as well.
And when you visit, I'm sure you see that women play a very important role in Armenia in education, don't they? Both in the numbers of students and in the way they excel in education.
Yeah, it's wonderful to see, and you know, we looking forward to more and more women. But I'm pretty amazed at the young people who have really taken a leadership role in Armenia, and I have to be honest, that's what gives me hope for the future.
It's great. We're going to take another break on All Things Armenian. My guest today is Dr. Mary Papazian. She is the president of San Jose State University. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with her.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlo Dermagerdichian. Today during our breaks, we were listening to pieces by Gomidas, the Armenian composer, performed by Edvard Mirzoyan and his group. We listened to Vagar Shapat, and we also listened to a piece called Ail Ailuch. So these two pieces from a CD by Edvard Mirzoyan. My special guest today is Dr. Mary Papazian. She's the president of San Jose State University, the oldest public university in the Western United States, or West Coast. We've been talking about her earlier career and her move up to president, and we talked in our last segment about a little bit about her connections with Armenia. But I want to spend our last segment talking about your tenure at San Jose State University. You've been there nearly 4 years now. And I read a quote which I thought was very interesting that you have quoted, the educator Steven Anderson, who said about leadership approach, "Alone we are smart, but together we are brilliant." Can you tell me how that's worked into your leadership style?
Sure. Yeah, I've been actually at San Jose State 4.5 years, so the time has passed. But it really speaks to the power of the team. You know, the president is the sort of identified leader, but you never lead alone. You really do lead with a team and as part of a team. And I've been very intentional about ensuring that I have a leadership team, both within, say, the cabinet level or the vice presidents, but also the next levels down, who are empowered to really work for the benefit of the institution as a whole. So my leadership team is, each has its individual responsibilities, of course, but we look, you know, I look for people who are thinking more about the whole and the success of the institution and our priorities and not just about their own personal success. And the other way of saying it is that we're greater than the sum of our parts, and that's really what's behind that.
And another quote I read about that you said, it says, "If I think about my own leadership style, it's always energized by imagining worlds that aren't here yet." And I thought that was interesting. So can you elaborate on that? What were you thinking about when you made that statement?
Yeah, maybe this comes out of my background, studying Renaissance literature, where the poets would imagine worlds that don't yet exist. So much was changing, and they would try to imagine what it would be and put language to it. My own view here's the thing. Leaders are both visionary, but also you have to make the trains run, so you have to be managers as well. But I find that what's exciting for me is to imagine a place we haven't yet gone and then try to build and empower people to get there. If you will, the other way to think about it is seeing around the bend, you know, what's coming next. And I think it opens up more space for creativity and innovation. Otherwise, I think people just worry about the tactical, changes we have to make. And I'd rather imagine something that is more powerful. Just as an example, in my first State of the University address to the San Jose State community, I talked about aspiring to be, the most impactful and preeminent metropolitan university in America, right? Seems very audacious, very ambitious. But behind it is really a commitment to engaging, empowering, interacting with our community in meaningful ways. By doing so, we create opportunities for our students. We do research and scholarship that addresses the problems of the day, et cetera. And people just sat there, and I paused for a minute, and I said, "You've got to believe. You've got to believe you can do something meaningful. And then we can figure out how to get there." So that's really, I think, what was behind my comment.
And actually, as a president, then you have projects and you have goals. And one of the interesting things is that Money Magazine has named San Jose State as the number one most transformative university in the nation. What does that mean to you? What does that recognize for you?
Well, we're really proud of that because it really speaks to the core mission of public higher education, in my view, which is that this is the avenue for realizing the American dream, for success. And that particular identification, Money Magazine was looking at institutions that bring students who are, you know, in the lower part of the socioeconomic ladder, if you will, and educate them and set them off for success, you know, so that they are launched into more and more successful lives. And for me, that really gets to the heart of what we're here to do, that as a public university serving a strong first-generation population coming from many of the communities around us, to provide that space and that experience that sets students up for success long-term in leadership is really at the heart of what the university is about. And so everything we do is really centered on seeing where our students have come from, providing them that support, ensuring that they don't just have access to the university, but frankly, that they graduate and they're set up for success in whatever area they want to make an impact. So really empowering them with the tools to do that. And that's really what's exciting about leading a public university like Fresno State or San Jose State.
And you have to continue to say that, repeat that message, right? Because universities are not isolated from the communities that they live in or from society. So can you just elaborate a little bit more on that, why you think it is so important, the role of the university in transforming these students?
Well, I think our students, creativity is everywhere. Talent is everywhere. It's just opportunity that isn't. And if we're going to have the kind of engagement and multitude of perspectives that will really help us as a local community, but also more broadly, solve the most significant problems of our day, we're going to need to empower our students to do that, to bring all their full being, you know, to address those problems, whether it's around climate change or urbanization or the disparities in health or wildfire science. And, you know, one can go on and on. And I think, you know, having the benefit of students who are coming from multiple perspectives at the table, you know, I think really creates the kind of innovative solutions that ultimately will ensure that our community is healthy. We don't live always in healthy communities. And I'm a strong believer that the university is the public square of the community, and it needs to welcome all of those perspectives. And engage with that community to help address the problems that are most present.
And as I mentioned earlier, presidents of universities both have opportunities to make, as you said, a really impact in the community, but they also face significant challenges in the operation of the university. One of the most significant, I know at Fresno State, has been really the fact that the state of California has been progressively less supportive of state universities. So the percentage of state support has gone down. How has that provided for you a challenge and maybe an opportunity to do things differently?
Well, maybe I've worked in different states. So I spent my time in Michigan and New Jersey and New York and Connecticut, and each of those four states were less generous than California. Still, I'd like to see more investment from the state of California. We just, we haven't published this yet, but we've just completed our first economic impact study. What is the value of the investment that the state makes, or every dollar into San Jose State, for example? And what we found is for every dollar in is producing $23 of value. And that's a huge return on investment. So the overall impact, and it looked at 1 year, it looked at the year 2018 to 2019, the overall impact, both direct and indirect, of San Jose State and its investment was about $4 billion for the state of California. So these are, and this is going to be true at each one of our universities, that we really are the best investment the state can make. And I would say this, we're not a cost, we're not an expense, we're an investment. We're an investment in human capital. We know that students who have an education, have the opportunity for an education, live healthier lives. They live lives where they contribute. They pay their taxes, right? They they contribute to whatever, you know, again, area, whether it's in healthcare or it's in IT or you name, you know, professional services, whatever it might be. They also are less of a burden on the social services. So the state's best investment, I don't think there is a better investment for the state to make than in our public higher education system. What we try to do is just be smart with our dollars. We know that we have so much coming from the state, and the state's been pretty good about keeping it pretty stable. I've seen much worse in other places. But we also serve a student population that really we don't want to burden with student debt. And so we are very intent on trying to keep tuition affordable. When you and I went, Barlow, we didn't pay tuition. We paid fees. And it's really important that we keep it accessible by keeping the cost down. So we try to be smart with our dollars. We try to find ways to leverage them, you know, to create functional systems so money's not being frittered away. We invest in people. We are hiring, continuing to hire faculty, because at the core of our mission is the education of students. And without strong tenure line faculty, you know, it's really hard to maintain that excellence. And you know, all our students deserve excellence in teaching. And then we're also thinking about ways to be innovative, right? What kind of partnerships can we develop? We're developing partnerships, you know, with industry, you know, to help support, you know, scholarships for students and maybe academic programs and other kinds of things.
And your argument, I think, is very convincing that really, truly, the public universities are an investment that brings back many more returns than what is invested in them. Just have a couple more minutes left. Maybe you can give us a vision about where you're headed in terms of your tenure at San Jose State. What are you looking forward to achieve in the next 2-5 years in that time period? Do you have one or two projects or things you're thinking about?
Yeah, you know, we've actually launched our 10-year strategic plan. We call it Transformation 2030. So it's really looking over the decade of the 20s. And it's very aspirational. It's really looking at how, again, we build out the faculty, but we're looking to invest in the kinds of opportunities that allow our students to graduate and, you know, in higher numbers, with more success, with elimination of the achievement gap, but in also ways where we're addressing the most significant problems. You know, whether, as I said, it's climate change, whether we're impacting the real issues that are facing us. We're coming out of this pandemic. We want to come out of this pandemic a more equitable and fair and just society than when we went into it. And so really looking at ways to build out, say, the multidisciplinary scholarship, the opportunities for every student to have to engage in undergraduate research or to have a global experience, to think differently about the intersection between technology and the humanities, because this digital transformation that we're living in and we're experiencing is going to require more of an understanding of the impact, not just on individuals, but on communities. That really is going to be the challenge of our time. And so we're trying to position San Jose State to be that place where students can come, experience, and think about these questions in serious ways, in partnership with faculty, graduate with intentionality, without student debt, and move to become leaders in their society. And I think we're well positioned to do that, really paying attention to our unique location as the only public university in Silicon Valley, which is that global center of innovation. So that's what we're really looking to do, and to do it in a way that elevates our reputation, because people turn to us as a place where you can serve students who are first generation, right, who are diverse, and set them up to really be agents of change in our society more broadly.
Well, it's been a pleasure having this conversation with you, Mary. I really enjoyed talking to you about all of these different topics. So really thank you for joining us today.
Well, it's my pleasure, Barlow. It's always great to be a part of these conversations. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. And just a couple of upcoming events through the Armenian Studies program. We're going to be starting our spring lecture series, all virtual. And our first guest will be political consultant and commentator Eric Hakopian, who will speak on Saturday, January the 30th at 10 o'clock in the morning, Pacific time. And his topic will be the Artsakh War and Armenia, a conversation with Eric Hakopian. Our listeners are familiar that there was a war in Karabakh, Artsakh, from September 27th to November 9th of 2020. It had dramatic consequences both on Armenians in Karabakh, Artsakh, and in Armenia. And our commentator, Eric Hakopian, will be our guest. And you can go online to our Armenian Studies program homepage at fresnostate.edu/Armenian Studies, and you'll need to do a Zoom registration to find that. That's a talk by Eric Hakopian on Saturday, January the 30th at 10 o'clock in the morning, Pacific time. That's 1 o'clock on the East Coast. And if you have friends in Armenia, they can listen to it because it'll be 10 o'clock, 10 p.m. In the evening. Once again, and that information can be found on the Facebook page of the Armenian Studies program or on our website. Once again, our special guest today was Dr. Mary Papazian, president of San Jose State University. And for all things Armenian, this is Professor Barlow Dermogradichian wishing you a good week ahead. And we'll see you next week for another episode of All Things Armenian.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
This was a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Este fue un programa pagado y solo refleja la opinión de sus anunciantes. Ahora continúa disfrutando de la programación de 1600 AM.